Is there a secret to happiness? And just what is happiness anyway? It's one of the first things we learn in civics class, the Declaration of Independence, declaring our inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. What did the founders mean by that? What does anybody mean when they talk about happiness? It is a question that philosophers have been studying for millennia, from Confucius to Aristotle, Nietzsche to Henry David Thoreau. And it's a question that's back in vogue. It's even showing up on magazine covers. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the meaning of happiness and whether it's achievable. We'll learn about positive psychology and the power of creativity. And we want to hear from you. Do you think it's possible to be truly happy? And if so, how? Join our conversation. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We hear quite a bit about happiness. There are songs about getting happy, self-help books on achieving happiness, and articles with advice about how to be happy or happier. What do we really know about happiness? How do we define it? And what are the reasons people pursue it? Today, I have three guests with me in the studio to help us try and understand happiness. Kelly Parker Gilbert is a visiting professor of psychology at Bowdoin College. Kate Winninger is a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern Maine. And Paul Schofield is a visiting professor of philosophy at Bates College. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you believe there are certain things that lead to happiness? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Facebook page. So I realize that this is a question philosophers and scientists have grappled with for centuries. Who wants to take a gander at defining happiness for me? Kate, you're smiling.
Oh, I'm always happy to do this. Aristotle talks about happiness a lot, and he talks about it as both doing well and faring well. The definition is really a word that translates into flourishing. So he talks about people who are moral, that means the doing well part, but also faring well, meaning being fortunate in your life. So sometimes things happen that you have no control over.
So the doing well is not getting rich. The doing well is doing good.
Right.
Right. Paul, want to add to that?
I think the word happiness is one that if you open up a dictionary, you're going to find a number of different meanings, right? And so I think the way that I like to come at the question is to ask, well, what is it that we care about when we, in a context where we ask the question, what would make me happy, or what, how could I go about bringing someone happiness in this instance, right? So, to give a concrete example, my daughter, 7 years old, sometimes is really antsy, and you can't satisfy her, and at some point I'll say, well, what would make you happy right now? Well, that, you know, in that context, I just mean something like, you know, what would satisfy you in this one instance? That's a perfectly sensible way to use the term. But I mean something very different when I say, insofar as I'm trying to bring up a child and raise a child, what would lead to a happy life for the child? And I take it that that's the kind of thing that we're asking, you know, when we devote an entire hour of a radio show to
talking
about.
Right. Well, ice cream cones are nice, but we are talking about the state of happiness.
that's right. Or living a happy life. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So these two are philosophers. You study psychology. Kelly, is there a different way of looking at this from your...
So from a psychological perspective, we look at happiness being comprised of two different components that kind of work together and build off of each other. One being the hedonistic aspect of happiness, and that's really the operating on the pleasure principle, things that make you happy, things like ice cream cones or bubble baths or, things that just make you feel good. And then that's balanced kind of in a yin-yang relationship with the concept of eudaimonia, which is finding purpose.
Eudaimonia?
Mm-hmm.
Spell that.
Eudaimonia.
Oh, a new word today. Eudaimonia. And tell me again what that is.
So that is finding purpose or meaning.
Finding purpose or meaning.
So doing something that really makes you engaged and feel like you've found purpose in life. So that could, you know, it moves beyond the concept of just what makes you feel good and moves into what makes you feel engaged.
At the very top of the hour, I read from the Declaration of Independence, the founders wanting us to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But we've really been thinking, as the human species has been thinking about happiness a lot longer than 1776. Kate, tell us a little bit about the history of thinking about happiness. How far back does it go?
Well, certainly I mentioned Aristotle, Plato and Aristotle both talk about it. But this idea, eudaimonia, is one that that Aristotle talked about. And when he thought about human beings, he thought about us in terms of animal needs, emotional needs, and intellectual needs. So a person isn't going to be happy unless they have food, water, shelter, but also emotional needs. And also, because we're social animals, we live in community. So living in a harmonious community. So you're going to see in Aristotle the concept of eudaimonia, which he called flourishing. Right. So in philosophy, that means when all those needs are satisfied. But realizing that that doesn't always happen for people, and sometimes there are challenges to that.
How does Paul? How does studying happiness from a philosophical vantage point translate, or does it translate into advice for everyday life?
Well, that's a good question. So I think when philosophers think about happiness, they're asking a very fundamental question about how it is that we ought to live. So insofar as we're asking that question about how to satisfy some particular person in a moment or make them feel good at this particular juncture in time or for the afternoon, I don't know that I have that much to say about that as a philosopher. But I think that since the time of Plato and Aristotle, there's been maybe – I think it's fair to say that the fundamental question in at least practical philosophy has been what kind of life should we live? What is the good life to live for creatures like us? And I think the way that philosophers begin to answer this question is to sort of put out what I would consider to be the common wisdom. What do we think is worth doing with our lives? And then begin to ask whether or not that can, what we think about the best life can survive rational scrutiny when we have a conversation like this one. If I think that the good or the happy life involves making a whole lot of money, that might be a first pass at an answer. But then philosophers subject that answer to rational scrutiny, and we have a conversation to try and figure out whether or not it's justifiable.
Kate, is there a way to, Kelly, is there a way to measure happiness?
So that is a very pertinent question to the field right now. So the field of positive psychology focuses on how to measure happiness. And, you know, one of the inherent challenges is that it's a difficult construct to measure, right? A construct is something that we conceptualize but can't physically see. And with things like temperature, it's much easier to measure consistently. But with happiness, when we're not really sure exactly what it is, it's hard to narrow down those measurements. So generally, everyone agrees that a subjective assessment component is important, right? So it matters how someone thinks they're doing. You can't just look at it objectively and have someone else measure it. You need that subjective piece to see how you're doing. So there are more subjective measures, and trying to figure out how to balance that with looking at it a little bit more objectively. So it's a work in progress, but there are measures being developed.
You mentioned the field of positive psychology. What is positive psychology?
Excellent question. So positive psychology came in the last 4 or 5 decades, really out of this movement that psychology up until that point had really focused on what's wrong with people and how do we fix it. And so, you know, positive psychologists are saying, well, we should also be focusing on the flip side. What are people's strengths and virtues? What is the more positive aspect of this instead of focusing on, you know, what are the psychological disorders? How do we treat them? You know, that's not all psychology is. And so the positive psychology movement has grown out of that in focusing on strengths and values, focusing on happiness. How do we measure those things?
So does it look at things like resiliency as mm-hmm. well?
Absolutely.
Okay. Kate, I understand you've done work and studied the role of creativity mm-hmm. and happiness. What are the findings? What's out there?
Well, I study philosophers who I studied particularly Friedrich Nietzsche, and one of the things that he addresses about using creativity is sometimes when you don't fare well in life. For example, he had lots of pain in his life. He thought, well, how can we transform what we're given if we're not given something that's great, right? So he thought, well, music is something that's soothing and that can bring us happiness even if we don't, you know, we don't do well in the world. So what kinds of things can soothe us or can even make our life ecstatically wonderful when something happens to us that isn't that great, right? We may end up in poverty. We may lose someone who's horrible or something terrible. Friend of mine experienced sexual violence, and she was a dancer, and she made up a dance about the experience and transformed that horrible experience into something that was beautiful. She was able to perform, and so that's using creativity to actually take control of an experience in your life and to turn it from something that could be something negative into something positive.
It's interesting you say taking control, and Paul, I want to bring this into the conversation. In doing some reading for today's program, that did seem to be one of the themes that emerged as, over and over again, is when people feel as though they have power and control over their own lives, they can seem to be happier.
Yeah, I think that's right. Having a sense that you're powerless or that that others are determining what it is that the way it is that you're going to live and all of your choices makes it feel as if you're not living out your own life. It's not yours. And I think that's a way of living that I think diminishes flourishing in the way that we were talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have an article in front of me from Time Magazine. I love this, and I'll go through it a little bit throughout the show of things that can make you happy. And some of them are things we've all heard. Gratitude, 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 gratitude. Spend as much time as possible with people you like. Give, savor, strive. But this is the one that I think is my favorite. It says, be optimistic even to the border of delusion. What do you think of that, Kelly?
I think there is definitely a role for healthy optimism, but you don't want to conflate that with kind of this Pollyanna mentality of everything's great and everything's going to be fine. And if you think positively, you'll just be happy, because the research doesn't support that. I think optimism is important. I don't know if I'd go quite as far as to say to the point of delusion.
It says to the border of delusion.
To the border. Okay, so maybe approaching that border. I think healthy optimism is important. You know, positive emotions are important. So there's been research done on what's called the critical positivity ratio, which shows that for every negative emotion, that should be balanced by at least three positive emotions to maintain this ratio of happiness. And so you want the positive to outweigh the negative, but there's important space for the negative as well.
I think this brings up an interesting question, though, about the extent to which happiness is just a state of mind. So if it seems plausible to think that you could live a life full of enjoyable delusions, and I think it's reasonable to ask, is this a life that we want to deem a happy one? So if I'm thinking about a loved one and what the kind of life that I want them to live when I say I want them to live a happy life, am I going to be satisfied with the answer that, well, if they live this kind of life, they'll be completely satisfied, but completely deluded as well. They'll believe that they are the greatest writer in the history of the world, but they have no talent at all. One thing that I worry about in these discussions about happiness is that we emphasize the subjective side while ignoring the sort of objective facts on the ground, so to speak.
And I think one important piece within psychology that we look at is functional impairment, right? That's an important piece because, you know, someone's mood state is very important, but also is there impairment in their lives? You know, are they functioning in their job, within their family system? And, you know, if someone's totally delusional, chances are you're going to be seeing impairment in other areas of life.
The first bit of advice, and really this is everywhere, it's on social media, it's in many faiths, the idea of gratitude and being thankful for what one has. And on its face, it seems obvious that it's right to be grateful. But does this at some point turn us into lemmings? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a distrust of this gratitude because who are we supposed to be grateful for? It's turning our attention in a peculiar way elsewhere. But I'm not sure why I find it so uncomfortable. I guess people I respect basically don't like this kind of language either. I find that when I'm in a kind of place, turning to action rather than gratitude and trying to find somebody that I can help is something that makes me feel better rather than being grateful for something. And that's normally what I try to do is to turn to action rather than thought.
But does it have to be one or the other? Can't you express gratitude while also helping?
Gratitude to whom about what?
So I don't think it's necessarily about who you're expressing it to. It's just appreciating the things that you're grateful for in your life.
And maybe that's the word that is a more precise word, appreciating, appreciation.
Yeah, and I think maybe I would be more comfortable with that idea of making sure you balance what you're thinking, you know. And I think maybe some people want us to be grateful to remember that there's a balance of good things that are happening and bad things, to go back to that idea that we talked about in the beginning, that there are ways in which we're faring well and there are ways in which there are challenges, and sometimes we get into a space of looking only at the challenges, right, and not the things that are happening very well.
This is fun. We have to take a quick break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. We're talking about happiness, and we'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Lamy Wellahan, a Maine family-owned shoe store since 1914, committed to keeping the entire family comfortable, healthy, warm, and dry.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with Jennifer Egan, whose new novel deals with mobsters in Brooklyn during the Second World War. And we'll take a look at a real estate deal that almost got Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. in very hot water. That's next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
You can catch the New Yorker Radio Hour tomorrow afternoon at 2 and Sunday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio.
Questlove didn't really want his band, The Roots, to join The Tonight Show.
And what Jimmy managed to do was disarm us in less than 10 minutes.
I'm Alec Baldwin. Coming up on Here's the Thing from WNYC, I speak with The Tonight Show's Yin and Yang, band leader Questlove, and host Jimmy Fallon.
Can you say I'm in love with you?
Here's the Thing starts this Sunday evening at 7 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, what does it mean to be happy? With me in the studio, Kate Wininger, a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern Maine, Paul Schofield, visiting professor of philosophy at Bates College, and Kelly Parker Gilbert, visiting professor of psychology at Bowdoin College. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet @MaineCalling or post to our Facebook page. And we'll start now with a Facebook post a Facebook post. This is from Robert. He writes, happiness is best understood as the absence of discomfort and therefore cannot be achieved directly, but is the result of avoiding discomforts, which may be physical, psychological, or social. Thoughts?
When you were talking about measuring happiness before, there is a philosopher, 19th century philosopher, Jeremy Bentham, who actually makes a calculus of pleasure and pain. And he has charts to measure pleasure and pain. So he does actually use this idea of absence of pain as one of the ways to calculate pleasure. So if you're going to go out and get drunk tonight and you think about, is this going to bring me more pleasure or not? You think, okay, I'll get intense pleasure this evening, but tomorrow morning, how will I feel? And what kind of pain is predictable from this? And what do I think about the experiences I've had in the past?
So Bentham would measure one against the other?
Yes, absolutely. Well, and he has a very complex, it's really called a calculus. It has charts and everything in it to figure out, you know, what this caller is talking about, I take it, which is it's not just how much pleasure, but how much you're going to also avoid the pain that might follow from it. So some things look really good because they look like immediately there'll be an intense pleasure. But if the long-term effect of this is that pain will follow from it, it's not desirable.
Paul?
So I wonder about the extent to which we should understand happiness as the absence of discomfort, because you might think that happiness involves a certain amount of discomfort. So you might think that a happy life is one that involves certain kinds of unpleasant experiences that are appreciated for their own sake, but there are ways in which they're not terribly pleasant. So, for example, you might think that running a marathon is an activity that is not very comfortable. It can be very painful, but it could be part of a happy life because you're using your capacities as an athlete or a runner. Or you might enjoy a tragic play which involves emotional discomfort. And you might think that that's part of what you would consider to be a good or happy life on the whole. So I think I'd push back against the idea that discomfort is necessarily something that takes away from happiness.
You're nodding.
I would agree. I was talking about the critical positivity ratio before of 3 positive emotions for 1 negative emotion, but that relationship actually breaks down once you get around 11 or 12 positive emotions for every 1 negative emotion. Because people need negativity in their lives. It builds resilience. It serves a function.
Interesting.
And you can't just have the positive.
You know, it's
negative.
Funny. I had heard that about compliments and criticism. For a healthy relationship, 3 compliments mm-hmm. for every criticism.
Yep.
So,
it's
interesting that there's that equivalency there. We've got an email from Diana. My foundational position on happiness is that we don't find it, we choose it. The idea of finding happiness makes the source of it external and introduces the idea that we might not, through circumstances and bad luck, ever find it. The ability to feel happiness is not dependent on our circumstance, but on our capacity to allow ourselves to realize sources of happiness within ourselves. We have to cultivate happiness. Misery, on the other hand, is an easily reinforced bad habit since everything isn't going right for us practically ever. You're nodding, Kelly.
So I would agree with some of that. I think sometimes circumstances can be important. Like, you know, for someone who's living in poverty or who doesn't have basic needs met, that is definitely going to impact happiness, you know, and you can cultivate gratitude and make the best of your situation. But if you're not in that circumstance, it's going to have a clear impact on your ability to be happy. So I think there is absolutely an active component, but circumstances are not unimportant.
No, I agree with that as well. I think that it is, happiness is somewhat in our control. Aristotle thinks that external circumstances matter very much to the amount of happiness that you have because the external circumstances can affect your ability to flourish, to use your capacities to do the sorts of activities that give your life meaning. And if you're in a condition that prevents you in some way from doing the things that are important, that detracts from your
life. Sure, if you're living in a war zone or starving, right. Given the number of people in our society today who have enough food to eat and have a roof over their heads and have friends and family, we all know people who have been given a lot and have a lot of external comforts, yet are pretty unhappy a lot of the time.
Well, some of them really, I think, feel entitled to more and more, which is a very puzzling phenomenon, I think, and I don't always know where that comes from. When they have so much in comparison, a lot of them don't know that comparison. You know, they don't have an experience of people who do not have much. I mean, sometimes they don't even have that experience within their own culture, let alone having traveled to some place where people have so much less.
And Kelly, isn't that something that's been studied in psychology, that once people have something, they take it for granted and want the next thing? I can't remember what it's called. Maybe you know off the tip of your tongue.
So it's habituation, or it's also called the hedonic treadmill.
Hedonic treadmill, that's what I heard.
And so actually one of the interesting findings that's come out of positive psychology research is that in the last 40 or 50 years, we see that median income has tripled, and the things people have gone way up, yet we see life satisfaction staying flat, and we see psychological disorders on the rise. And so it's kind of this paradox of, you know, seems like money may not have the impact that people think. And one interesting finding is that often when asked what would make people happier, they say money, but the research does not support that.
And I've seen articles about lottery winners who are much less happy after they win this money, and the stress is on their life. So we're going to go to the calls. We'll go to Melinda, who's calling from Dresden. Hi, Melinda. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling in because I am, according to my friends and family, the most optimistic, positive person that they have ever met. But I want to say that I believe that happiness and optimism are two different things, only because to be an optimistic person, truly, in my own experience, it doesn't mean that you're not confronted with really horrible things in your life, that you're not confronted with challenges, that you're not confronted with negativity. For myself, it's the ability to flip that negativity around and find the learning possibilities and therefore the optimism in that negativity. Happiness, for me, is something that's completely outside of my optimism. In other words, happiness for me is an amazing sunrise. Happiness is seeing a tremendous natural beauty on, like, a double rainbow. It creates this sense of joy in my soul, this amazing ability to lift myself out for even a few minutes. That is happiness for me. Happiness, holding my grandchild for the first time. Happiness, seeing two people who are obviously in love walking down the street, gives me this sense of overwhelming joy. That is completely different from my optimism.
Melinda, thank you so much. Yeah, thank you so much for calling in. Thoughts, panel?
Oh, she's going to love Nietzsche. So, I mean, that's what I had written down that I didn't get to. But, you know, just Nietzsche talks about living through lots of pain and then just saying, you know, it's a moment of joy that makes your life really worth living. And, you know, the experience of music, the experience of art, experience of nature, and that is what he talks about, happiness. And I think what she says about optimism is also interesting too, which is to be realistic in confronting things that are challenging, but then when you notice them, you identify them, and you figure out, okay, now what do we do about them?
Right, appraisal is very important, and one of the generally looked upon as positive coping strategies is what's called cognitive reappraisal. And so it's looking at a situation, kind of exactly what she described, saying, you know, okay, how can I reframe this to learn from it? You know, I interviewed for this job and I didn't get the job. Instead of saying, well, you know, I'm a bad candidate, you can say, okay, this job seems like it wasn't a good fit for me. How can I learn from this and move forward? So kind of not writing it off but saying, you know, how can I think about this in a different way and have it help me move forward?
We'll go to Deborah in South Portland. Hi, Deborah. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to mention the previous...
Oh, no. Deborah, we seem to... Wait, hold on just a second. Deborah, I'm sorry. For some reason, we seem to cut you off. Are you still there?
I am still here.
Here, start over again. Sorry about that.
Oh. Okay, I was going to say, I don't see myself as an optimist, but I do see myself as very happy, and I'm finding increasingly that I will turn to my husband and say, you know, I'm really happy. You know, I've been 40 years married, reasonably healthy, three children on their way in doing well in life. And we try and help out in other ways to people who are less happy. But I guess I'm not happy about the political situation, but I try to put it in perspective. But as a human being, with the things that I have and the relationships I have with the people around me that I love, I'm happier than I have ever been, and I'm 68, so I think that's a pretty good deal.
Well, Deborah, I was going to ask you, do you feel as though you're wired happy, or do you feel as though you have gained happiness over the years?
Yes, I am not wired happy. I had lots of issues when I was younger. This is something that has come to me. I've been married for 40 years, and this is something that's come to me probably, if you can believe it, in the last five or six years that I realized how much I have, and I realized this is what happiness is.
So this is the appreciation we were talking about earlier.
Absolutely. For me, it's a learned thing, you know, to stop fussing and worrying and fretting about things I can't do anything about, and just be joyful in the good things that I have in my life, and I have so many.
Thank you for calling, Paul.
Yeah, so I think that brings up an important aspect of the topic, which is we sometimes talk about happiness as a feeling or a mood that you have in a particular moment, right? I wake up in the morning and I feel happy, or I don't feel particularly happy because I have to go to work. Then there's a different meaning of the word, and I think that's what we're here talking about. That involves something more like looking at the conditions of your life and having a positive attitude toward them and being willing to embrace and endorse them. So I don't think that there's anything about what the previous caller just said that requires that every moment of her life along the way were ones in which, you know, she was feeling little pangs of joy or anything like that. It's that she came along to a certain point in her life where she was able to look back at all the things that she had done and accomplished and the relationships that she had, and she is able to endorse them. She thinks that they're worthwhile and that they're meaningful, and I think that's an important sense in which we can live a happy life. And when we say, I want to live a happy life, sometimes what we mean is, I want to be able to get towards the end of it and say, yeah, I did well. I endorse that. I feel good about the things that I did.
Kelly?
So there's two things that came up for me when you were talking, Polly, and the previous caller. The first is the role of social support, which we haven't talked about a lot, but is hugely important. As Kate mentioned earlier, we are social animals. Relationships and good social connections are hugely important. In a lot of research on psychological disorders, social support is a hugely protective factor against those things. So I just wanted to comment on that. The other piece that came up in the context of the call is the role of mindfulness. And that's something that it goes back to Buddhist tradition, you know, many, many years ago, but has kind of made a resurgence within the last few decades. And that's really this idea of focusing on the present moment and trying not to think about the past, not to think about the future, and just be present and notice what's going on without judgment, and to really experience that and not worry about what comes next or what's going on or what might happen tomorrow, but really just staying in that moment.
Thanks for your call, Deborah. We have, an email from Mark. I work to live my life with a positive state of mind. In some psychology class in high school or college, I learned that if you think you are happy and positive, your outlook will be the same. What is there power to just deciding to think a certain way? Darn it.
So, you know, cognitive style or attributional style is an important piece, but that's not the full story. You can't just surely will yourself into being happy. You know, with the role that we've seen in research of positive emotions and the power of positive thinking, it absolutely can contribute, but it's not the whole story.
We'll go to Ellery calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Yes. Well, thank you, Jennifer, for taking my call. And I'm happy to say I've learned quite a bit today.
Oh, good.
I've been called annoyingly happy at times, and I've been called a lot worse, but that's not the point. I'm curious as to whether or not, I know there's a, I don't wear a pair of rose-colored glasses. I don't even have a pair. And I know happiness is a sort of a relative thing, but and I know that happiness is not enshrined anywhere in law except that brief wording in the Declaration. So I'm curious, is it possible that there could be such a thing as too happy, not manic happy, but just happy, too happy?
You mean this is something your friends who call you annoyingly happy might say?
Yes.
Thoughts? Okay.
Well, certainly, happiness as fulfillment is certainly, you can't be too happy in that sense. I mean, you know, a fulfilled person, you might annoy people who aren't fulfilled, but I don't think that's something that's capable of being too much. Now, I don't. Yeah, I can't see that being a problem in any way. But there are other senses of happiness that we've discussed that might be seen as problematic.
Right. So it would be possible to be in a good or a happy mood all of the time in circumstances and situations where it would be completely inappropriate. Right. So if if a tragic event happens in front of you, or you're at a funeral and you're skipping around and smiling and laughing, there seems to be something wrong with that. So insofar as you're working with that particular conception of happiness, where it's just a mood, then I think you probably could be happy in circumstances in which it's simply inappropriate.
Or maybe if our caller is happy before he's had his coffee, that could be very in the morning.
Right. And I think, you know, thinking about happiness as just the presence of positive emotion is a dangerous way to think about it. Right. We need to acknowledge that negative piece. You know, it's not, for the reasons Paul was just pointing out, you know, it's not healthy to just have positive emotion all the time. You need that negative again.
Ellery, thanks so much for calling in. We do have to take another quick break. You are listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Collins Center for the Arts with Aquila Theater's live production of Hamlet, a Shakespeare classic, October 12th, collinscenterforthearts.com.
U.S. Border Patrol agents are on the alert for drug smuggling and human trafficking near the border between New England and Canada.
People will come here and either pick up the people that have walked into the U.S. or they'll drop off people that will walk into Canada.
But they also have broad authority to stop cars with immigration questions, and that concerns civil rights lawyers. On Next from the New England News Collaborative, we'll walk the border. Please join us.
That's coming up at about 20 minutes after Maine Calling. Maine Public Radio is bringing new sounds to your weekend routine. We've added some new programs that will be sure to inform, inspire, and entertain you.
And welcome to Planet Money. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
It's How I Built This from NPR. I'm Guy Raz.
This is Hidden Brain. I'm Shankar Vedant.
This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing.
To learn more about the new sounds coming your way, visit mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Meaning of Happiness. Joining me today, Paul Schofield from Bates College. He's a philosophy professor. Kelly Parker Gilbert from Bowdoin College, a psychology professor. And Kate Winninger, USM philosophy professor. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We have an email from Corey. It is interesting to look at how the capitalist model has hijacked the concept of happiness in the modern world. In a capitalist state, you are trained to achieve happiness through transaction. Humans, as the Declaration of Independence attempts to illuminate, are entitled to pursue happiness and freedom simply because they are alive. We exist for the sake of ourselves rather than the sake of the state. And if a government must exist, then it must allow for freedom, which is the mechanism by which human beings achieve the happiness they deserve. Kate?
Oh, nice one to throw at me there. I think that's a very general question, and I'd like to answer it about the United States. And I think the kind of model of capitalism that we have is attached very much to Puritanism and Stoicism in our culture. And so if we're going to talk about happiness here, then we need to address those things, which is instead of happiness in the sense of Aristotle, which is flourishing and having all of these things, there is also a sense that you can be happy if you sort of grit your teeth and bear the bad things that happen to you in life. And so there, within the puritanical aspect of our culture that is attached to capitalism, is that you put your nose to the grindstone, that you work hard, that you accumulate capital, and that is, in effect, a never-ending battle, so to speak. And that may contribute to something that we spoke of earlier, that people, even when they attain middle or upper middle class or even become rather wealthy, just never become satisfied with that.
And do you think that's the kind of happiness that the framers meant when they wrote the Declaration?
No.
What do you think they meant?
I think they were probably better schooled in Aristotle than most of the people.
Paul?
Yeah. So I think that question brings up a broader issue about about how politics relates to the topic of happiness. So I think many of the discussions that we have about happiness in popsology and things like that have focus heavily on the individual and what the individual can do to make her life a happier one for her by making particular decisions and taking taking up certain attitudes towards her life. But there's a whole nother question that we can ask about the ways in which we order our society and the ways in which that prevents certain people from flourishing, from living a happy life, or ways in which it permits them to do so or enables them to do so.
Thoughts?
So kind of tying in, I'd like to just back up to the role of money and happiness, because we've touched on this and talked about it a little bit, but just to kind of bring in some of the research that has been done on it. So what's interesting is that money impacts happiness if you don't have enough of it, right? If you're living in poverty, if your basic needs are not met, money absolutely will impact your happiness. However, once you get beyond that, there's not that much incremental happiness added. So we see a positive kind of uprising correlation between money and happiness until about an annual income of around $50,000 a year. And then once you hit that, you really aren't seeing substantial increases in happiness. So things kind of flatline after that.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. So when you have enough to satisfy basic needs and maybe a little extra, mm-hmm. after that,
money doesn't really impact how happy you are.
We'll go to Tony calling from Old Town. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, why would we not refer more often to the Greek philosophers, which they said, everything in measure is best. Pan metron ariston. That's what it means. Eumonia, evdemonia in Greek, means good living with logic. Healthy mind in a healthy body. Refer to the story of King Midas, which he had the ability to touch everything and turn into a gold, until he touched his daughter and turned into a statue of gold, you know? And how about the cynical Diogenes, which asked Alexander the Great to step aside because blocking the sun? Why people don't learn those things to have a meaning in their lives?
Tony, thank you for your call. Kate? Your kind of guy.
Right. Well, maybe you weren't there. In the beginning of the hour, we did talk a little bit about Aristotle's both idea of faring well and of doing well. And doing well is the idea of a virtuous life, which is what this caller is talking about, which is the golden mean, the mean between extremes. And also I spoke about the idea of happiness as flourishing, meaning that you have these elements of your life that you have food, water, you have food and shelter and emotional and intellectual, social parts of your lives that are fulfilled, but not in, but again, always in a temperate way, which I believe this caller is speaking to. Perhaps someone else could.
And it's also important for Aristotle that we behave virtuously, or that we have the virtues, right? Mm-hmm. So part of what happiness is for the Greek philosophers that the caller was talking about is acting in a way that is ethical and moral and having characteristics that are the virtuous as opposed to the vicious ones. So it's a really broad concept that includes all of the things that would contribute to a good life. And so I think what the caller might have been getting at was that maybe we have a too narrow conception of what happiness is now when we talk about it like Bentham did, where it's just about pleasure, it's just about how you feel, and maybe we should have a wider, more inclusive idea of what it means to be happy.
I think this idea of balance and moderation is important in pretty much any context we're going to discuss, right? You know, going back to this idea of the hedonic treadmill, you know, we adapt. You know, if you get more and more wealth or material things, it may be exciting for a little bit at first, but then you adapt, and then what's next? You know, how can we go bigger and better? And that's a dangerous model to live by. So really acknowledging that.
All right. Tony, thanks so much for calling in. We'll go to Kitsy in Freeport. Hi, Kitsy. Go ahead.
Hi. I wanted to add that there's a quadrant missing to me, which is a spiritual quadrant. Happiness to me is more an emotional thing, but I have learned that joy encompasses both happiness and the other feelings of sadness or anger or whatever. And for me, the basic first thing is gratitude and thanksgiving. And I'm getting ready to prepare a sermon for a week from Sunday. And it's going to go back to the Iroquois Confederacy, where any time these six different nations in upstate New York and that area, many hundreds of years ago, they started every single meeting with thanksgiving, with the gratitudes. And it wasn't, they didn't talk about to God or anything else, but they gave thanks for life, for the sun, for the moon, for all of the animals, the fish. I mean, they grounded themselves on this planet. And from that core of gratitude, then they went on to their business, which could be in the left brain.
Oh, I was just going to say thank you, because we're running out of time, and I want to give my panel a chance to respond. Thank you.
I can just say, just quickly, that I'm not sure if this will be satisfying to you, but I've been going to conferences recently, and I have not seen this happen in Maine, but perhaps I missed it, where a conference begins, and I'm talking about philosophy, very abstract conferences, where people talk about the land on which we're standing and where it comes from and the people who live there. And it is a kind of gratitude to the people who came before us. And I find it very moving and very impressive.
Kitsy, thanks so much for your call. I think we have time to squeeze in an email. We may not have time for a response. Sue writes, I'm a person who has dealt with depression most of my life. I have it under control most of the time. But a few years ago, when I was on a beach vacation, I was feeling miserable. All of a sudden, a little child made me smile for some reason. A few minutes later, a man playing with his child made me smile. I started noticing all the things around me that were touching or funny or cute. So I started writing it down every time I saw something that made me smile. By the end of the day, I had pages worth of occurrences, and my depression was much better. I think this must be the same thing as gratefulness that people talk about. It definitely works for me. It just takes you to focus off the negative tapes in your head and look for the positives all around you. We just have a few seconds, but Kelly, you're nodding.
Oh, I was just saying that really touches on the gratitude aspect as well as mindfulness, being there in the present moment, what's going on around you, noticing, being present, not being caught up in those other thought patterns.
Well, that's going to be the last word. Thank you all for being here. That was Kelly Parker Gilbert, a visiting professor of psychology at Bowdoin College. Also, you heard from Kate Winninger, a professor of philosophy at the University of Southern Maine, and Paul Schofield, a visiting professor of philosophy at Bates College. Thanks all to you to all of you for being here. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling at mainecalling.net. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.